Welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. We have got a returning guest with us today, someone that we've known for quite some time. They've sent us a lot of watches over the past few years. We've met them a good few times as well, including down at the inaugural London Watch Show, which was a fantastic event last year. Let's not talk about the one this year so much, but we're here to talk about great things, and we have a great man on the line. We have Andrew from Zero West Watches. How are you doing, sir?
Very good, guys. Thanks for having me on the show again. Really appreciate it.
And this is your first experience of being double-teamed by me and Dave. Dave.
So yeah, go easy.
Strap
on me.
Up, strap in, and get ready for action.
I've been doing some training.
Seatbelts are advised.
Yeah, they are mandatory. Dave, how are you, sir?
Dave is good. It's Dave's perky enough today. Makes a change. I know I'm usually only perky for one day at a time.
You've been working out, Dave?
Working out.
Smarties and an ironing board.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes, well, let's start the show off as we mean to go on. Let's get the wrist checks nailed. You're the guest, so Andrew, tell us what you've got on the wrist today.
Today I'm rocking our new DB2 Lancaster chronograph, which is selling like hotcakes, as they say.
It's excellent. Give us the brief run through, because we're obviously going to get into the heart of the matter later on, but so that people can have their appetite whetted, hit us with it.
This is our first aviation chronograph, which I think is why it's been so popular. And it also features some material in the back from a crashed Lancaster that flew on Operation Chastise, which is also known as the Dambuster Raid. So,
oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent. Long time in the making.
And when did this one come out?
6 or 7 weeks ago.
Ah.
And it's been a blur
since. New to the collection.
Yeah, and very new, yeah.
Well, I mean, when was it we first met? It must have been 2019, before all the pandemic stuff. It was down at a show called...
Watch It.
Your little stand in the corner, because everyone had a little stand. It was a small room everybody was in, but your one stuck out like a sore thumb because the display you had, the presentation boxes, they were as good as the watches themselves, the amount of engineering and stuff that went in there. And then we've obviously spoken since. Met, obviously, at the London Watch Show. Dave met you for the first time there as well, and he got to experience the Zero West treatment in real life. So, Dave, why don't you have a little chat here? Because I've obviously said good things. I've seen the watches. You got to see them there. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting take. You've obviously taken a slightly different slant, maybe, from a lot of the mainstream, I think it's fair to say. You know, you've got a kind of theme around a lot of the watches. So when you started the company or the brand, did you have a kind of idea from the start that you wanted this kind of thematic idea maybe behind some of the watches? Or is that something that kind of evolved since then?
No, it was always something that was part of the brand. Graham, my business partner, who first came to me with the idea of setting up a watch brand, his background's ex-military engineer, did some black ops stuff, worked in aviation. So I think the most important thing when we first started was actually designing the bodywork to the watches, where it had its own identity. And that was really, really important to us. And we knew that in a saturated market, that was going to be really hard to do. But I think we've achieved it with the house style case designs that we've got across several of the different style watches. And that was the most important thing. So that was really the first remit for when we were designing a watch. And then following that, whilst we were prototyping all of that, we were developing the brand in the background. And everything kind of slotted together, because Zero West is actually a coordinate. It's 0 degrees rest that runs through Greenwich. It's the main line of longitude, the prime meridian. And then we kind of developed from that we would cherish British engineering feats of engineering, and that we would go through time and we would mark them with a date code and a latitude and longitude. So it was really, everything kind of slotted into place, but it was a massive amount of work. So really, that's it in a nutshell. I mean, I can go into a lot more detail a bit later on when we go through some of the watches, but each of our watches has three main things. It has an engineering achievement, a human element, and then an event. And then effectively we research that event, the human element aspect of it, and we basically pull the design cues from that event into our watches, not just with the engineering, but the story, the design of the dial. So it's more than just a bit of faceless marketing. It's really, really in-depth. And that takes an awful long time, which is why a lot of our watches we've been working on take about a year to come to life, really. And some of them take a lot longer than that, because also we've got the engineering aspect of it that's quite difficult when we're recycling some of the parts from crashed airplanes or motor vehicles and adding them to the back of our watches. But we never wanted to be, you know, novelty. We just wanted to be true.
So it's fair to say that a lot of your marketing materials are more the actual narrative and the story behind the kind of whole process of designing this watch. So in many respects, the marketing take care of itself. It's the kind of fallback from all of the kind of research that's gone into why the watch exists in the first place.
Correct. It was twofold, really. When we started the brand, I said to Graham, you know, I'm not a salesman. I just want to make, firstly, the best watches we can make, the best quality. It wasn't about a margin. It was just using the best materials, not cutting any corners. And I'm sure if we had an investor, they would probably cringe at some of the decisions that we make. But it feels right to us, and it's the way that we want to do it. And we believe wholeheartedly in our product. So effectively, we're just retelling the stories and just telling people with varying interests the different processes by which we brought those stories to life. And it's all about engagement. And people really engage with that and appreciate the in-depth background and research and, you know, quality that we put into everything.
Well, let's engage with a continuation of the wrist check, Dave. You can tell us what you're wearing. You thought we forgot.
I didn't know. We're just winding Mizzale up, because that will really annoy him, because he's got to listen for a bit to get to the next bit. So what am
I
wearing today?
He's going to have to go back and put details back in the way.
He has indeed. He's not going to enjoy that. So I am wearing today my Snoopy. So my latest generation Snoopy watch, which I pulled out. Don't wear it very often, but pulled out, and I'm wearing that today because it felt like a Snoopy kind of day.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about it, you dick.
Well, you know, details, mate. Who needs details? It is the third iteration of Snoopy from the Speedmaster family. This is the one that's the 50th anniversary of the Silver Award. This one is the one that you people will know famously has a little flying Snoopy in a capsule automated on the case back with the spinning earth, silver dial with the blue subdials, and it has become somewhat difficult to get your hands on, it would appear, after the fact. I very luckily got this one early on, but probably verging on, must be verging on 2 years ago now, so I've had this for a while. But yeah, I really enjoy it. I changed out the strap to the new style bracelet, which I actually prefer. As everyone knows, I'm moving from being not a bracelet person to a strap person to back to a bracelet person. So yeah, other than that, it is what it is. It's a Speedmaster, ultimately, but it's got Snoopy on it. And lots of folk hate it because it's got Snoopy on it, usually morally because they can't get one.
I know the feeling, because I remember when you first got it and it was like day one and I said to you, can you get me one? You were like, no problem at all. And that's been 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. No problem at all, give or take it being a problem.
Everything's a f***ing problem with you. Anyway.
Everything's a problem with me. Well, yeah, it's a pot kettle black there. Anyway, so what are you wearing, seeing as your third wheel in the cog this time?
It's a tricycle. I will take your little Snoopy cartoon character from comic books and I will beat it up with my Batman. So not worn this in a while, thought I'd pull out the box. Yeah, I should probably give it a lot more wrist time than it gets at the moment. I think it was probably a month ago, more than a month ago. It was when I was actually looking at cars was the last time I wore the thing, and somebody mentioned on my Instagram the other day that I should wear it more often. So I am. So that's why I'm wearing today. Got this just over 5 years ago, so the warranty's expired, but the watch still works fine. Still is buttery smooth to wind up and set and everything. Feels great on the wrist, isn't jingly jangly. It is my favourite. It is the watch that will stay in the collection forever until I need to actually sell it, and it would be a choice between that and my spare organs. Yeah, absolutely love it. The watch got me into the hobby, kept me in the hobby. So that is my wrist check for the show. Done and dusted.
Guys, I've got to ask, what would be your everyday if you had to, you know, as an everyday watch? What's your favourite everyday watch?
That's a good question.
Depends if we're visiting London.
Less bling.
What would be my everyday watch? Now, that's actually a good question.
Are you saying, what do you mean by everyday? Do you mean if we had one watch out of our collection to keep and everything else had to go?
Not so much. One that you're happy wearing every day, looking at a lot, and it's still, which might not be the most prestigious watch in your collection, but it just might be, it's... You know how sometimes you get a watch and after a while you kind of gets a bit boring, but other watches don't. They don't. They just, it doesn't matter how often I wear it, it just feels the same. It feels just as good as the day I put it on.
I think actually mine's one of my more recent acquisitions. It's a difficult question for me because I'm in a lucky position to have a stupidly ridiculous amount of watches. But actually, the little Oris Pro Pilot X, the new release from the 39, that watch I have worn disproportionately often since I got it, because it just feels so good on the wrist. It just fits well. It's comfortable. It's light with it being full titanium. Albeit I got the salmon pink dial. I think that makes it less daily, but if I'd got the blue or the grey one, I would quite happily wear that on and on and on and on, because it just is a great watch on the wrist. So that would probably be my current regular daily.
Difficult question. It would be the watch I'm wearing just now because it's my favourite, closely followed by the Arage, closely followed after that by the Mad One Red. But that changes all the time. Before that, I liked my Tudor. Before that, I would wear the Maurice Lacroix. So there's always a changing lineup, but the number one position is always held by the Batman because it's the one I have taken on all my trips. Apart from Dubai, I don't think. I think that was the only one I didn't take it on. It's the one that sings to me the most. And as I say, it's the one that I wouldn't get rid of. And every time I put it on, it reminds me why people say that Rolex fit and finish and quality is there and lasts, because that's half a decade now and the thing is exactly the same as it was day one. But I wouldn't want to wear it in the gym and damage it. But I wouldn't want to wear it when I'm on my motorbike, and I definitely wouldn't want to wear it in London. So, yeah. You know, there has to be a little asterisk beside things saying where and when and what doing. But yeah, those three are my kind of run through at the moment, or a G-Shock. That would probably be the sort of the go-to for everything if needed. How about you? Here we go. Let's throw it back in you. Let's stir the pot. Of your releases, what would be your number one? And you can't just pick the most recent one.
It would be the Spitfire, based on the Smith dial. It was one of the early watches we did. And I just think it's got for me anyway, it's kind of timeless clarity to it. It's aviation, but it's...
It's your headphones falling out?
It's my headphones falling out. Mm-hmm. But
I thought it was Dave's butt plug for a second. Put it in sideways, it won't fall out quite as quick.
But the S1 Spitfire, I've got it in a silver case. We made 5 of them. That's quite a special watch. We should have made more of them, but you learn as you go along.
Well, you actually sent us one of your Spitfires. I think it was S4, maybe?
Yeah, the sold out S4.
Yeah, you sent us that one to have a look at, along with, oh God, I can't remember what you sent me. I think it was a Cafe Racer, I remember that. And there might have been a Bullhead Chrono in there as well.
There was, our original Bullhead. In fact, that the S4 really was the watch that imploded our brand from a collector's point of view. We sold out in that watch, and that kind of really set our stall out for people that had looked into our brand but didn't buy that watch, who subsequently decided not to wait so long for future releases. So yeah, that was a great watch for us, the S4.
It's a good story when you sell out of something and you have that built up demand waiting or hoping that one will appear in the secondary market, because not a lot of smaller brands have that luxury of collectors waiting, wanting and hoping that something will pop up in Chrono 24 or eBay.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest surprises that I've come across over the last couple of years is just how many of our customers have got more than 2, more than 3, many have got more than 4, and they're all desperately trying to get hold of watches that they didn't buy early on, or they came across the brand later on, which is great for us. And it's not uncommon. Well, I had a customer yesterday that came from Wales who was really keen to put down a deposit on a watch that won't come out till the end of the year. He doesn't know what it is. And I have to say that just before we launched the Lancaster watches, there are 3 in that range, we had a deluge of inquiries with people looking to do the same thing. It's not something we normally do, is take a deposit before somebody's seen a watch. But it's great to have that demand. And I kind of have this little black book of customers that are, if we ever come into contact with a sold out watch, that we give them a call so that we can link people up together.
I mean, it's really nice to hear that, because, you know, that kind of, I think, runs in parallel with what we're hearing from quite a lot of those, you know, more, you know, newer British brands, you know, whether it's yourself, whether it's Nickett Fears, whether it's Anne Ardain up here in Glasgow, whether it's Richard Benk, you know, at Studio Underdog.
Yeah.
A wide variety of prices, styles, aesthetics, but all of these brands have the demand. They've got these short production runs necessarily on colours or designs or dials, and they're in demand, and people just are desperate to get them. And I think the nice thing actually is you very, very rarely see them coming up in the pre-owned market, which says that the original owners love them and want to keep them, which again is not something you necessarily see for a lot of other watch brands.
I think it's great for the British watch industry that there's this following, and from a collector's point of view. And like you say, you very rarely see not just our brand, but like the brands that you mentioned, very rarely do you see, very rarely do you see anything come up. And that's great for everybody. It's great. Really says where the market is, and what the other British watch brands are all striving towards.
Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously we do a lot with the Alliance. We've had them on many times. You've been brought up with these other brands. And let's recap then, because the last time you did a full episode was approaching the 2-year mark. It was towards the end of 2020. It was pandemic mania, and things were all up in the air. We had no idea what was going to happen coming into the end of the year towards Christmas. Bring us up to speed then, from the end of 2020 forwards, what's been going on?
Well, the pandemic for us didn't really, I mean, we were busy as we came into the pandemic, and then it went super busy. I'm sure, like a lot of other companies, there were a lot of people who had time on their hands. And I almost feel guilty for saying this, but there were obviously, while some people or a lot of people were affected by the pandemic, there were other people who had disposable income and their interest were watches. And we benefited from that surge. And I think one of the things that came out of the pandemic for us that we would have done maybe differently, but we were able to do, was we sold an awful lot of watches where people didn't want us to post them out and would say, when we get out of lockdown, we're going to come, we're going to go on a road trip. We're going to come and see you. And we sat there and we thought, we had a really nice studio. It's an old boathouse overlooking the water just down on the south coast. And we thought, we're never going to have an opportunity to completely gut the boathouse and do it up where nobody can come, where we're not going to have to do it well. We're still getting visitors and we're still... So we thought, what would the bricks and mortar, what would our website look like if it was bricks and mortar? And I remember Graham over Christmas... took all the measurements of the studio and typical Graham, he 3D rendered the whole building right down to chairs, shelves, watches, stands.
Now he's the ex-MI5 secret agent guy, isn't he?
I can't talk about it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, he is. And, you know, the detail that he goes into, it was fantastic to be able to do that. And we had also had a customer that, that lots of customers want to help us out with their particular trades, builders and so forth. And we had a builder that was specialized in roll steel joists. And he made all our custom office tables and our meeting table all out of polished roll steel joists that Graham 3D rendered up. And it took about, we thought we could do it in about 5 weeks, and it took us probably double that, just over 2 months. But it looks fantastic. The lighting is reclaimed from the Castle Bromwich Spitfire factory. We've got a Mark 9 Merlin Spitfire engine in the studio, which is a whole nother story how we got that, let alone got it into the building. And it's fantastic. We've got this whole display with all how we want to display the watches, because we don't really sell through retail. We've got a couple of retailers, actually. That's not really true. We've got Giles in Lymington, Watches of Distinction, and there's BQ Watches. But as a whole, we mainly sell online and through the studio. So it's a great customer experience. And we had somebody that, you know, like I said the other day, that came down from Wales, and we've had people down from Manchester, and we've got a guy coming over from the States to pick up his watch. He didn't want it to send it out because he was in London for a few days in July. So that'd be great to meet up with him. So, yeah.
You might actually have a couple of Scottish people visiting you.
Hey, we got a fan. Oh, we built a minibar.
So, oh, right. Well,
I'll be there. We're there. We're there. Right, when?
He's got a great built-in cabinet. A watch is such a personal thing for somebody, and often the buying experience is devoid of that. You know, we're not like a normal shop where you're in and out in half an hour. We had somebody who was with us for 4 or 5 hours the other day. We took him for lunch. He's a very good customer, but we treat everybody exactly the same, whether they're interested in buying a watch or just want to come and see what we're about and how we do things. The door's always open.
I think that's an interesting narrative, as you say that, because I'm seeing that as well. You know, there's been a big swing in retail watches or anything else towards online, you know, Amazon, everything else, you know, online has become a thing. But I always did say it'll swing too far that way and it'll begin to swing back the way. And I think now you're beginning to see that, you know, brands that maybe set up and they were online only suddenly realizing that they have a demand with their customers to have that engagement, that one-to-one, that personal touch engagement. You know, and they may well transact online, they might buy it online, but they want to pick it up, they want to come and see the brand. So I think that's important. And again, even in the watch sphere, it's interesting to see the number of brands beginning to realize, yeah, we need to have a base somewhere. Doesn't need to be huge, but it needs to be somewhere that we can, you know, actually make contact with our clients. And I think that's it's nice to see. I think that's going to make things much more sustainable in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, where else can you, I mean, we've got all the models, the 3D printed models of all the watches. We've got sketch boards of all the dials designs, and we've got all the pieces or the remnants of some of the pieces that we put into the back of our watches. So it's a great experience. I'm not saying we ever take it for granted, but you know, we're slightly, because we've been submerged in it for 5 years or so. It's kind of wrapped around us on a daily basis, but it must be why these people travel such distances, because they're so passionate about their watches to have that. I'm going to pick it up from where it's built, where it was designed, and chat to the guys that actually design the watches so they can tell me more about it. It's all part of the, you know, part of the experience.
And it's taking the baby home from the hospital.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
How does the process begin with you guys? We ask this question to different brands sometimes because they've got a different way of doing things, a different thought process, and you've definitely got your own little niche when it comes to that. The designs, the Cafe Race or the Spitfire, where do you come up with the designs, the ideas, and how do you then implement them? How do you get parts of this particular vehicle or that particular monument? How does this all come about?
Well, it's a really good question, really good question. So, for example, the Lancaster watch, we've been asked, since we brought out the Spitfire watch, have you ever thought of doing a Lancaster watch? And the answer to that is yes. But for us, story-wise, there was only really one story, and it was the Operation Chastise, known as the Dambuster Raid. And unfortunately, getting material for that is kind of the holy grail. It's like gold dust, because of the 19 aircraft that flew, only 11 made it back. And then from those 11, they would often go off on other missions, not return, or they would be broken up or converted back to a different type of Lancaster bomber because they were modified for the raid. And it was, when you're a watch brand, you're really lucky that you get exposed to lots of watch collectors who are connected to the motorsport industry and to aviation. And we've been speaking to friends, and people kind of want to help you on your journey. You'll mention it to somebody and people try and connect the dots for you. And it's massively rewarding. And effectively with Lancaster, we came across a famous aviation artist called Mark Postlethwaite. And he's well-respected within the industry. He's a leading authority on Lancaster bombers. And he was part of the archaeological dig to go to northern France to identify this Lancaster that had crashed on a farm. And it was part of the original 19 that had flown on the raid. And he was able to help identify the modifications to the plane. And through him, it took a long time, took about a year. We were able to source some parts from that. And then from there, the process starts in designing the dial. And so for us, because the plane was all about the height that it flew, it seemed logical to us that the dial design should be based on the altimeter. The crews were 617 Squadron, and they were pretty much like Top Gun. They were the best of the best. An awful lot of training, and a Lancaster bomber's like driving a bus on three wheels. You know, it was not a nimble machine. And it took great skill from these young pilots to fly these big bombers to the desired height. And obviously with Barnes Wallace, which was a British scientist who designed this bouncing bomb, and they got the right height with torches and these altimeters. So that was the dial design was pretty much taken from the design cues from a cockpit of a Lancaster. And then obviously on the dial, we always have a date code, and we always have a latitude and longitude, and it always references that moment in history. And then we design the cases or the finish on the cases in our house style. To tie in with the era of the time. So with the Lancaster, it's all sandblasted matte silver. And then we use a custom motorcycle company local to us who smelts down the raw materials, and then they get melted, sandcasted into rods, and then they're machined off and wire cut into discs. And we design the back of the watch so that disc can be sat underneath a sapphire crystal. So it's kind of like history on the wrist.
This is not an easy, simple process. Again, I'm getting educated, and I was recently educated by somebody else, another British brand, when I was doing an open dial event. And it's probably a failing in my part because I see so many watches and I speak to so many people that I think there's a lot of automation. But it sounds like there's so much that goes in behind the scenes here that people look at the price of watches and go, that looks a little bit more expensive than perhaps I imagined. And this explains exactly why.
Yeah, we spent 3 days melting down the material, filtering it out, smeltering it. Then we took it to another engineering company to get it wire cut. And then Graham designed these special kind of discs for the disc to fit in the back. And there's so much work involved. Even with the dials, because we design them in-house, we do all the design work in-house. My background's branding and graphics. So I design the dials. You know, what you see at the end of it is kind of a reverse pyramid. Well, it's a pyramid, really. you see the final dial, but underneath it is probably 50, 80 different variations upon the theme that we stick up on a board and look at on a daily basis and finesse slightly. And, you know, in watches, every, you know, half a millimeter is a mile. So, you know, all these slightly variations. And the things that we cause us great grief are simple things like on the DB2 chronograph, there's the sub dial at the 6 and 12 o'clock has a red ring around it. And that red ring, which is more burgundy, matches the red rings on the booster gauges of a Lancaster bomber. We must have spent 2 days trying to get that color just right. But it was important to us. And for many people, it will just be red rings on a dial. But to us, it's that sort of detail, period correct, that was really important, because it's all about the detail.
Absolutely. It's, as you say, you compared it to a pyramid, or I would probably say an iceberg. You know, you see the little bit in the top and that's the watch, the final product, but there's a hulking great mass of stuff underneath, or the swan analogy. It looks graceful, but you're all going like mad underneath trying to keep yourself looking graceful on the top. It's all those little details. I was going to actually ask, have you ever run into any kind of, I guess, challenges or kind of pushback? Obviously, you sometimes use materials that are from what you could describe as, you know, historically relevant items, whether it be that Lancaster or other pieces you've done, repurposing that material. How much of a pushback do you sometimes get? I know I've got my thoughts on it, but I guess there's lots of people who sometimes say, well, it's a bit sacrilegious to take something like that and repurpose it. But, you know, do you get much in the way of pushback for that? And what's your thoughts on it?
That's a really good question. There's two answers to that. So first off, I think it's for us, we're keeping the stories alive, and that's really, really important. That's why the detail and being historically correct, we have a duty of care to get that right. And that's another reason why sometimes some of our watches take a little longer to come to life than others. And you can't rush that process. The other answer to that question is, we're currently working on a watch, which unfortunately I can't talk about, but we've got the material for something that is just so difficult to engineer. It's a challenge. Let's just say it's a challenge. It's not off something super old, but it's been designed so you can't do things to it.
Elephant Swift from Chernobyl.
It's not quite that. But yeah, we're working on some material at the moment for a watch that's proving really difficult to it. I mean, we'll find a solution to it, because that's what we do. But we took it to one of the companies that engineers some stuff for us, and the words "you must be joking" came to mind. But they are all we're very lucky that all the people we work with love a challenge. They're super interested in what we're doing, and they all want to be part of it. And it's like we're all like excited kids on some of these projects. So it doesn't feel like work some days. So we're very, very lucky and very grateful to be offered some of the materials we are for the projects that that we're working on. We do get offered materials for projects that aren't right for us, because it's not just about any story. It's about the right story. And the story has to, as I mentioned earlier on in the show, has to have the human element, the event, and the British engineering aspect to it. So that does rule out quite a few things.
All right. Well, let's talk about something extremely British. Let's talk about something associated with James Bond, and that would be his motor vehicle of choice, the Aston Martin. And that's something that you guys have been working on. Do you want to tell us about that? Because I've got back into cars recently. It's kind of been a big thing, so I'm kind of quite keen to find out what you've been up to.
Yeah, so we wanted to do a motorsport watch for a while, and we're just around the corner from Goodwood, which is like a film set.
Really? Shit, if we'd known that last year.
Seriously, we're about 6 miles from Goodwood. So yeah, when you come down and do your tour, we'll head over there for some spinning. But yeah, that's just around the corner. So we've always wanted to do a car watch, especially as our old boathouse used to be a garage. And back in the early days, just after the war, all the single-seater sports cars, or a lot of them, came through that garage on their way to Goodwood to be restored, a lot of the panelling. So it was in our kind of our history, really, our DNA from where the studio is, to actually bring out a watch. And so we were introduced to a family member the Gauntlet family, who owned Aston Martin in the 80s. And he said, yes, you can have this drive shaft. You can't destroy the visual integrity of it, but I'd love to be involved with the project and see this watch mark a fantastic achievement of the DBR1. So when we were looking through the research and the history of that DBR1 that Stirling Moss drove, in 1958, there was the Tourist Trophy race at Goodwood. And it was famous because Aston Martin got a 1-2-3. Stirling Moss won that event, and he won it in that car with the drive shaft from that car. So this seemed a fantastic story. And then we went on a mission to extract, almost like bone marrow, material from the drive shaft, which was really, really difficult. It was about the diameter of a tennis ball in places, and we literally at the top, and then we literally cored down into it, wire cut down into it, and managed to extract out a rod of the material without destroying the visual aspect of the outside, so it still, for all intensive purposes, worked as a drive shaft. And then that was sliced out, and that was put into the back of the watch. The front of the watch dial was very clean. It was emulated the race dials of a DBR1. with the 12 o'clock disc emulating the graphic that was put on the side of the DBR1 cars, which was the big white circle with the numeral in it. And the latitude and longitude goes to the start line. And we only made 58 of these for a number of reasons. One, because there wasn't much material. And two, to denote the 1958. And it's a great watch, that watch enthusiast. And that car, I must just point out, that car with that drive shaft went on the following year to win Le Mans 24 with Shelby. So it has a lot of history in it. So it was an exciting project to be involved in.
When did that one come out?
That one came out just before Christmas, literally. At Christmas.
Right. And do you have any left?
We've got a couple left.
Right. So be quick, listeners, be quick.
Zero West is a bit strange because we don't do an awful lot of marketing. You know, some people say, oh, you've been a bit quiet. And we've been a bit quiet because we're busy selling watches to customers and busy designing for the next watches. We're always super busy. We may not be in the limelight a lot, but we are very busy.
No, totally. Because every time I try and speak to you, well, every time I try and email you, it takes weeks, if not months, for us to connect. So we probably should have had this chat a long time ago there. But the watch that you mentioned at the beginning, we obviously cut you off short during the wrist check. But you can now tell us all about that DB2 Lancaster.
Yeah, so with the DB2 Lancaster, we've got three watches in the range, two three-handers, the DB1 and the DB1 Blackout. And then we've got the DB2 chronograph. And I have to say, all three watches have sold really strongly. We've hardly got any left of the DB2 Lancasters. They're literally almost all gone. But I think it's because it's the first time we've brought out a chronograph pilot watch. And the Bomber, it's a nice size watch. It's 44. And it just looks, it screams aviation. We've kind of hopefully nailed it on the design. And it's really exciting, the fact that this watch, but all three watches have material in it from ED825, which was one of the 19 Lancasters that went on the raid.
So you said that on that one, there's three kind of variations of it. Is that... Well, I'm going to ask you about the number. There's 100 pieces, yeah? So yeah, is that 100 total?
No. So we've got 100. We've got 100 for the DB2 chronographs. The DB1 Blackout, we've got 100. And for the DB2, we've got 200. The reason why we went, well, it's just that's how much material we had. And the case design for the silver one is brush polished. It's a beautiful case. And we sell it either with a black rubber strap, a leather rubber, a black or green or red rubber strap, which we designed in-house. And we invested in all the tooling locally. That was quite a big investment for us. Or you can upgrade to a handmade leather strap, which we make ourselves in the studio. And the straps are a real work of art. It's something that we've been doing since the beginning of the brand, because we weren't able to find a company that would produce them in small numbers that we wanted or to the quality we wanted. And Graham, who is the sort of person who can build his own house, said, I'll have a go at learning how to make them. And it took them about a year to perfect, but they really are amazing. They're hand-stitched. They're stunning. And the style of them really complements the DNA of our watch bodies. So they complement each other really, really well.
And you're continuing to do that, even though you could probably outsource it and get someone else to do it a bit cheaper?
Yeah, for the time being, yeah. It's I'm not saying that we haven't got a lot on order, but it's just something that customers, when they come in and can choose the thread colour, we can show them a selection of the leathers. And we're just about to update the website over the next month, and that will have all the straps on it. So yeah, it's exciting. It's part of our DNA, really. It's more of a personal service. It kind of bonds us to our customer base, really. They really are excited at being able to have something made just for them, not just the watch, because we build the watches to order, but actually they can custom spec a leather strap. Some of our straps have World War II canvas in, so they're kind of recycled. And we've spent a lot on all the embossing tools and all the workshop to have all the best stuff to make them. And we use great leathers, Horween leather, and some other leathers. So it's great. And it allows us, we had a customer with a very small wrist recently who was keen to wear one of our watches. And we've had a customer who had a very large wrist, and we can custom fit them. We can custom make them. So it's great to be able to offer that customization in-house.
Now, you've obviously done quite a bit when it comes to meeting and greeting people. You've done things with everybody, Paul Thorpe, ourselves. What's it like being able to actually meet and greet folks at the watch event now that we've kind of come out of the pandemic? Have you got other ones coming up? Because obviously we met at London Watch Show, you did the second one. Have you done other events, and what's on the calendar for this year?
Yeah, it's quite fluid at the moment. I think what's exciting for us is now that we've done the Boathouse Studio out, we're keen to push events there. It's obvious that people are quite prepared to travel a long way, want to speak to Red Bar Southeast, see if they'd be interested in holding an event there. And, you know, we'll put the spread on. We'll invite some special people. There's some stuff that we can, lots of things that we can do to make it a great night or a great weekend for people. So that's something that we're looking to spend more time doing. And also, like you say, the London Watch Show, when we came out of the pandemic last September time or in the summer, going to the London Watch Show was fantastic. I mean, we've done two now. And just even if nothing else, just meeting all the all our customers, people wearing their watches, it was hugely exciting. And what's always great is we get phone calls now from people who go, I came around your stand, but you were so busy, I didn't get a chance to see your watches properly. Can I come down and have a personal viewing? And yeah, we do that sort of thing. It's great.
Okay. Ricky, dumb question time. It's that part of the show. Have you thought of tying in one of your events at your sort of base of operations when there's a Goodwood thing on, like a members meet or a whatever?
The thing that's a great shame for us is we're not allowed to go as a brand to Goodwood, to any of their events, apart from a breakfast club that they do for cars on a Sunday morning. Not allowed to go to Revival or Festival of Speed because they're tied up. Festival of Speed this year is tied up with Cartier, and Revival is Rolex, and they shut all the brands out. It's watertight. We've spoken to them a few times, and they're a great crowd up at Goodwood, really receptive to the brand, really like what we're doing. We're really on brand for them because they like to support local companies. Still would love it to happen. Still would love it to happen. But you are right, you know, tying something in around the same weekend is something we've talked about.
That would be a great idea, because we are finding out more and more week by week that folks that are into mechanical watches are petrol heads, cars, bikes, airplanes, whatever it is. And if they're going to perhaps go to Goodwood and they're coming down and they're staying somewhere, if you're that close by, if you had an event on the night before or the evening before, or the evening after, or the evening of, instead of them just going to their hotel, they could drop by, check out the watches, get a souvenir. Loads of ideas kicking about there.
Oh, definitely. The whole village where we're based is all the hotels get booked up, you know, with everybody, all the cars in the car park, or people going to Goodwood. The next morning, you get woken up early doors with all the exhaust going. And it feels like a mini festival in the village. So it is something that we are looking to take advantage of, and especially now the studio is looking as cool as it does. But like you say, planes, bikes, cars, they all go hand in hand, and watches, obviously.
Yeah. Indeed. No, yeah, definitely. Yeah. More and more I'm seeing this. It's becoming more and more apparent. And maybe it's because it's coming into summer and more people are starting to take their bikes out. I'm seeing all the posts going up on Facebook and Instagram. And this isn't people that I know from the watch industry or the watch scene. This is people that are into mechanical, petrol-headed type endeavours. And then suddenly I see them posting something to do with watches. I'm thinking, oh, potential new subscriber right there. So yeah, definitely. Any other watches that we've forgotten to talk about?
Ah, there is one. So we have an updated bullhead design, LS2. The LS1 was really, as far as I'm aware, we're the only British brand that does a bullhead watch. And so basically that's effectively a stopwatch in a cradle that Graham designed. It's really distinctive looking. It is super cool. Before it had a polished cradle and a black cylindrical watch part. Now it's all sandblasted. It looks really vintage. And it's got an exhibition back with a custom movement, Valgeau movement, with a custom red rotor in it. Spoke design. That is a really, really cool watch. We're only making 50 of those. It's not on the website yet, and I think we've sold 8 of those so far, just from people coming into the studio. So we're looking to launch that in the next few weeks. That'll be up on the website. But if anybody's interested, I can leak some photos. But it's a great looking watch. Part of the reason why we did that watch was because it basically commemorates the land speed record on Daytona Beach. First vehicle to go over 200 miles an hour. And like I said earlier on in the show, our boathouse used to be a garage. And just after the war, the guy that owned that garage worked on the original paneling for that land speed vehicle. So it seemed a fitting tribute to tie it all in together for us.
Absolutely. And I think you're right in saying there's, you know, the bullhead design, you know, is something that has existed in watches for a while, but very few brands actually make it. And there's very few. I know of the bigger brands, Omega have done a couple historically, but you rarely see them. And I know that the Japanese Seiko have done a couple of bullheads over the time, which again, you rarely see. And I think you're right. I can't off the top of my head think of any other British brands that are doing one. This is the point probably where some listeners will go, oh, I know of somebody, but I think you're right. I can't certainly off the top of my head think of anybody. And it's a pretty cool design, especially with that whole motorsport heritage, because it does fit in to motorsport and aviation as well, so it fits well into your kind of brand portfolio.
I think with the bullhead design, the most recent thing I remember, perhaps, was a watch Brad Pitt was wearing in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, possibly, actually.
I think that's probably it. And obviously, you've sent us one of these watches, a prior iteration before, and it is so cool to have it on the wrist. It just kind of makes sense, because sometimes it's difficult to do things with the crown round here. You're trying to dig underneath the wrist and you've got the bone in the way, whereas when it's at the top, it's very easy to access.
I think for us as a brand, you know, especially when I chat to Graham, it's really important for us to...
Does Graham exist? Is he a figment of your imagination?
No, he does.
Is this when you've got a small company and you pretend that you've got more people actually working for you? You've got lots of multiple email addresses and stuff, and you put accents on when you answer the phone?
Still the same person.
Yeah. All your multiple personalities.
Yeah. Split. Well, but, you know, it's really important to show what we're about. You know, there's no point if you're able to design in-house, which is why we've changed the design slightly, not because there was anything wrong with the original one, far from it. It was just, we can. So we just updated it slightly, and it looks super cool. It looks really cool.
So for the listeners that are not following along at home with the show notes that we keep telling you to do, because that's where all the pictures are. You don't have to click on websites or anything. You just look at the one page and you scroll down chronological order. So what are the differences then between the previous ones and this one?
Well, apart from the polished cradle and the black cylindrical watch part that slots into the cradle, which it's all now sandblasted, we've taken some of the weight out of the cradle. So it's slightly thinner at the 6 o'clock. So it's more sculpted. It makes the watch look slightly smaller, but it's a very, you know, you can't get a designer bullhead without it being having a certain amount of presence. But we 3D printed it beforehand, and it's a great size. It really does feel comfortable on the wrist. And then we've also now got an exhibition back, because before it was an engraved back with a beautiful picture of the land speed vehicle, whereas now it's showing off the custom movement we've got in there with the red rotor. And it's also got a machine disc framing that exhibition window that's got a reverse printed crystal with a laurel wreath on it that denotes the land speed record. So it all ties in beautifully.
You're going to have to send us some of these to look at then.
Yeah, I will.
My next question would be, your watches are very rugged. They're designed for people that are into cars, aviation. We've discussed that previously. Do you find that there's a lot of females buying your watches, or is it predominantly males?
We do have some females that ask us or have bought our watches. Or we had a customer turn up the other day and his wife, who came along with him, was wearing one of his watches, one of his other Zero West watches, which was quite cool. It looked great on her. Yeah, we do have some female customers. We do get asked a lot if we're ever going to produce a range or build a story around a female achievement. Yeah, there's so many things we want to do. It's, we're ideas rich and time poor. We've got some different shape watches on the drawing board, so to speak. Yeah, there's some great stuff in the pipeline over the coming years. We've kind of got a two-year roadmap that's kind of slightly fluid, but you have to be thinking that far ahead when the watches take so long to come to life. So it's exciting and frustrating at the same time, because there's 101 things I'd love to talk to you about today that I probably better not talk about.
Is this you angling for another show in another year? Are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Book me
we'll
in now.
We'll drip feed the information out to people.
Another thing that you'd mentioned there was, you know, you were kind of ideas rich and time poor. How have you guys found it over the last couple of years? You know, we're speaking with a lot of brands, from the kind of the big multinationals through to the small brands, all saying that they're being affected by, you know, supply chain issues, whether it be movements, glass, cases, hands, dials. Is that something that you're finding as a challenge at the moment as well?
Yeah, I think what did we have an issue with the other day? Strap pins, you know, and it's kind of, you're only as good as the last part. You know, it doesn't matter how good everything else is, your movements and everything else. It'll be something, you know, our watch boxes, we had a problem getting those. There was a slight delay on those because the raw materials were delayed getting to the people that make our watch boxes. And that was something that wouldn't have necessarily been on our radar, because we've never had a problem with that before. So sometimes the supply chain or the delays that you think you're going to get don't always come from the areas that you think they will. And the other thing that I think is difficult is, as we've grown and we're becoming larger as a brand, we're constantly having to think and order things in a different way. Just when you think you've got it sussed out and how long things take, and then all of a sudden the landscape changes because you need to order in a different way, think further ahead for things, and everything changes. So you're constantly learning, and it's great when you catch up with some of the other British brands because you often find that there's a commonality in some of the issues and things that you're striving for. There's a lot of synergy in that.
We had Paul from Fairer Universal on just a couple of weeks ago there, and he was telling us about getting crystals. That was something he had never experienced issues with, but himself and Nicholas at Fears had issues with that.
Well, that's interesting. I can't say that we have had an issue with crystals.
Dave has issues with crystal meth.
Yeah, I've got to stay on the class A's, you know.
No supply issues there.
Well, before we finish out the show, we always like to end on a high, and we're not talking about Dave's crystal meth anymore. Have you got any interesting stories from the trenches, anything you can sort of share with the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I took a phone call, it was just over a year ago now, and one of our watch collector friends said, "Oh, I've got a friend, he's restoring a Spitfire. You ought to go and have a look at it." And I was like thinking, it can't be true. And I thought, this sounds interesting. I'm sure it's not quite as it sounds. And he said, yeah. You give him a call. So I give him a call, and there's a guy on the other end of the phone. He goes, I'm restoring a Spitfire. Yeah, you want to come and have a look at it? Yeah, no problem. But you can't tell anybody about it. It's a secret. So I'm thinking, it's probably a scaled down Spitfire. It's probably something he's making for his kids or whatever. And
best you not tell this story on a worldwide podcast, I'm thinking.
Well, it's okay now because it has a happy ending. Okay. But so we
I like happy endings.
Yes. So we make this trip out, and we go to this farm, and you know, it's one of those farms where there's a chicken on a sofa outside, and there's a Land Rover from 1965 that's got one wheel missing, and there's this big barn door, and you're thinking, this will be interesting. And literally this guy pulls back the garage doors. I was going to swear. Oh my word. It's like massive hangar with a whole fuselage of a Spitfire Mark 9 with the wings off. And there's a guy in overalls with all like the Top Gun patches, like literally restoring it. And it was like, I was like a kid in a sweetie shop. They're like, they had a supply, they had a room to the side, which was their storeroom, floor to ceiling shelves. There were like wing shields. There was like dials from all different Spitfires. They were trying to get it period correct. It was just amazing. And we were chatting away to him. We spent like a whole morning there. And he said, I've got the engine here. It's we can't restore it. It's too far gone. It's got a bullet through it. He goes, do you want it for the studio?
Jesus Christ.
So he said, what, like a Merlin engine for the studio? He goes, yeah. He goes, it's pointless it being here. Nobody's ever going to see it. So we said, yeah, that'd be fantastic. So I phoned my mate who's got a lorry, and literally next week we were there with a forklift truck lifting up this Merlin engine, getting it onto the back of a low loader. And then we managed to get it to the studio, and we had it on some wheels on a crate, and we couldn't move it. It was too heavy. It was like stuck outside the office. And we were thinking, how are we gonna get it in? And long story short, it took six of us a whole day with a ramp, two mobile cranes. We'd just done the studio floor. We had to get these mobile cranes that are like the ones that take engines out of cars with the chains, genie lifts, with a roll steel joist going across the table so that we could put it into place. And I always remember that we promised these guys, look, if you help us out, we'll take you to lunch. So they were on a mission to get it in there. And we got it stuck in the door. In the doorway. And it was like, and you know when you're kind of losing the will to live, and they're losing the will to live because we'd promised them some pints at the pub. And I wasn't sure we were going to get it out the door. And it got to mid-afternoon, and it was like, we were like literally really stuck. Anyway, we managed to get it over the threshold of the door. We managed to get it in. We managed to lift it up over this custom roll steel joist table that we'd made, and we managed to get it into position. And I remember the guy saying to us, that's it, we're off to the pub. And I looked at it and I said to Graham, is it me? Or is it not quite straight?
Oh, God.
And the problem that you've got is when you're into watches, you know, to the average person, it was straight. When you're into watches, it's just that minute detail. And the guys are looking at me going, no, it's straight. Trying to convince us it's straight. Anyway, long story short, we got the spirit level on it and everything. It wasn't straight. The air was a bit blue. It took us another couple of hours to get it straight. And It looks amazing. It looks absolutely amazing. And it's one of the highlights of the studio now that we've got it done, all with we've fitted a custom glass top to it and it all lights up from underneath. And it looks incredible. There aren't many places that you can go and see a Mark 9 Spitfire. And we've actually rendered the plane, illustrated the plane, and that sits above it. And we've got a whole story of this. It crashed in northern France and it will feature in our watch range at some point. But it was just one of those points where somebody offers you something that's too good to be true, and then you know, with a bit of prior planning, realize how difficult something that seems so simple is not that easy to get into your studio. But I don't think anybody will be stealing it anytime soon.
How heavy is this thing, and how big dimension wise?
Well, it's the width of a door, literally, because there was literally nothing to you could barely get a sheet of paper either side, and I'd say it's as long as a car bonnet of like a Ford Capri or something like that.
Must be a good meter and a bit long, probably.
And the other thing you think about is, no wonder there were so many craters in farm fields when these things were shot out the sky. Because if it's that heavy, just that part of it, can you imagine that just crash landing somewhere? It'd just take out.
If that buries itself in the ground at a couple of 100 miles an hour, it's going to leave a mark. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah. Which is why so many of them get dug up, because they literally...
They bury themselves.
They bury themselves, bury themselves.
The question I have to ask is, the restoration of the actual Spitfire, have you found out how far along that's come? Has it got itself back in the air yet?
That is a fantastic question, Dave. It was supposed to fly this year, but it's behind because of COVID. It's now at Duxford, and it's being restored there. The rest of it's being restored there, and it has to be restored there. To be able to fly.
To get its flight certificate.
Yes, a flight certificate. And really excited to see that fly next year. Yeah.
They are beautiful things to behold when they're in the sky. And it's amazing that there's so many now back in the sky after many years of there been hardly any out there.
Oh, completely. And there's a fantastic story around this plane and this engine, which we'll be retelling at a later date. Really, really, really interesting story. So yeah, excited to be part of that and follow the journey of its restoration and see it finally flying again one day, which is what we're all about, really, just keeping those stories alive and embedding that history into our beautiful watches.
Well, if people want to keep the story alive on a personal level, how do they get in touch with you? Where do they see these watches that you've currently got on offer?
Okay, well, first off, there's the website, which is at zerowest.co.uk. And then anybody is welcome to visit us. Always best to give us a call first, because we're not like a normal shop. Sometimes we're out getting stuff made and doing shoots and stuff. And that's down on the south coast in Emsworth, which is in between Chichester and Portsmouth on the south coast. But give us a call. Our number's on the website. We welcome visitors all the time. It's great.
There's this thing called Instagram. Do you use it?
Yeah. At Zero West Watches. At Zero West Watches, yeah.
Perfect, that's the easiest place to point people towards. Well, listen, it's been good catching up. Although we've had you on for like brief snippets for 10 minutes here and there over the last couple of years, it's just good to sit down and spend a full hour having a proper catch-up. Because even at the London Watch Show, I introduced you to Dave, and it was literally, here's Dave, oh, you've got customers, we need to go, and we left you to it. And it was constant, it was bedlam start to finish for you guys.
Yeah, it was a chocker show. I'm sorry, Dave, we couldn't chat properly then. I'm just looking forward to, you know, if you're out and about later this year, visiting places, we'd love to see you at the Boathouse. It'd be great for a proper catch-up and take you out. And
Minibar.
Minibar. Get stocking.
Yeah, that was the first thought.
Sounds great. So yeah, when we do our long-awaited, long-postponed tour due to COVID, we will make sure to come and see you.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Thanks for spending time with us. If people want to check out what we're up to, we are on Instagram as well, at Scottish Watches. We have a website too, scottishwatches.co.uk. Drop us an email, info@scottishwatches.co.uk, with any ideas you've got on future shows or feedback on prior ones. Tell me and Dave what we got wrong. We like to find out when we do nice things and when we do bad things, and it's predominantly bad. Fill in the gaps that we've left there. And if you want to check out, obviously, anything that Zero West are up to, you heard there, at Zero West on Instagram, zerowest.co.uk is the website. And we are keen to get these watches across that we've now been promised, so we'll be sure to update our own social media following and website with pictures when these watches arrive. So thanks for joining us, Andrew, and we'll catch you guys again soon.
Really appreciate you having me on. All the best, guys. Cheers.
Take care.